My guest is Justin Webb. Justin Webb is the presenter of BBC Radio 4's Today programme in the morning. Welcome to the podcast, Justin.
Thank you for having me.
Justin is the author of a new book, The Gift of a Radio, My Childhood and Other Train Wrecks. You say in the book, Justin, spoiler alert, that the idea for the book came from your agent. But when he suggested the theme, did you have any kind of hostile or nervous reaction to the idea?
To be honest, Paul, I didn't know what he was talking about. He said, can we meet and have a chat? And I said, yeah, of course. And I'd written a very short piece for a website about my school days. I mean, literally 1,500 words, saying that I went to a very strange Quaker boarding school. And he said, I thought he wanted me to write a book about America, actually, where I'd spent a long time as a correspondent, and I write a bit about America for the paper. So I went along thinking that, and he said, no, it's about you. And initially, with not only due modesty, but also actually just a sense of why? I mean, what could possibly be interesting about my childhood? But he then persuaded me, and I think this is why I went ahead and wrote it, that actually writing the story of anyone's childhood allows you to say other things about the period, about the issues that there were, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, my childhood was deeply eccentric, to put it mildly, not to say completely screwed up, and but it was happening in the context of Britain in the 1970s, which was also deeply eccentric and screwed up, and the two sort of came together. If I could write a novel, I said to someone else, if I could write a novel, I probably would have written it as a novel, but I've got no imagination. As you know, Paul, I'm a limited person in so many respects, and I couldn't imagine how I would do that. So I thought second best was to write it as the story of me, but the story, I hope, of something a bit more than just, you know, what happened to me on a wet Tuesday in 1972.
Well, it is a remarkably candid book. You don't pull any punches, you say. It was a deeply eccentric childhood. Did you decide at the very outset that you would be as candid and as open as you are in the book, or did that kind of evolve as the drafting process took over?
Actually, that's an interesting point. I probably didn't realise when I started off, it's an interesting thing writing a memoir, I probably didn't realise how candid it was going to be, because, of course, the more you think about it as you write, and I don't tend I don't write notes or think particularly about what I'm going to write before I write it. I tried to be quite disciplined, write kind of 700 or 1,000 words a day, and just write what came into my mind. And of course, the more you do that, then the more you dredge up things and realize their significance and put them together. And people have read the book and said it's brave, and I mean it's sweet of them to say so, but it really isn't, because
brave in a Sir Humphrey way,
you mean. I mean, yeah, exactly. Bravery, I prefer to keep that word for people who genuinely are brave and rescue people from burning buildings and all the rest of it, rather than this. But it's it is troubling to do, and you do have to face up to those troubles, I suppose that is true. And the more you do it, the more you realise, actually, there is no point in doing it unless you are willing to be open. You can't hold anything back. And I realised quite early on in the book that I wasn't going to.
Did you find it almost therapeutic, almost cathartic then as an experience? You, as you say, dredging these things up. Then did you have a stage where you say, oh, God, even if you're just writing to yourself, talking to yourself, you got it off your chest, as it were?
Yeah, possibly. I didn't do it as catharsis. Didn't do it with setting out with the purpose of that. But I think probably it does help you to come to terms with the things that have happened to you, and not only to come to terms with them, but actually in a sense to kind of forgive. And indeed, part of it is my own sense of atoning for my own uselessness as an adolescent, how I was towards my stepfather, who was sort of excluded from the family, who was desperately mentally ill, and I think we should have treated better. So it's not about the things that were done to me, it's also the things that I did. And at school, you know, there was a lot of bullying, and I certainly didn't do much to stop it. So you reach a stage where you are explaining events and not necessarily justifying them, but talking about how they are in the round. And I think that that probably is psychologically, actually, I think we should do that more about all events and everything, because we are, everything should be seen in the round. And that's partly, you know, again, if it had been a novel, that's partly the kind of point of the book, really, I suppose, is that there is too much judgment, there's too much snap judgment. I mean, it's a cliche to talk about social media, but it is a fact that we live in an age where people are not properly allowed to atone for things, to explain things, and the kind of just the psychological wellsprings of why we do believe the things we do, I think are interesting.
What is striking about the book, and the reader, this reader, me, was quite regularly thrown off balance, because you say you don't pull any punches describing both in your childhood, both in terms of how your mother treated you, how she behaved, and your stepfather. And you think you think the reader's being led to a conclusion how awful it was and how awful they were. But on the contrary, you're great pains throughout the book to say that you love both of them, you understood both of them, you had great affection for both of them, even though in their different ways they were quite particular people, shall we say.
Yeah, no, exactly. And then my mother, at one stage, my wife Sarah read it and said, "Well, your mother comes out of it in not a very good light," but I think she just comes out of it in a more rounded light. So in other words, I was essentially she was the single parent of a child. It was a desperately intense relationship, one of kind of adoration on both sides. I could see no way of living without her, and all I wanted to do from a very early age was please her. And it makes you, that kind of makes you as a child into a performer more than a child. And I'd say in the book, there was nothing sort of normal about my childhood. There was none of the kind of easy ability that children have just to laugh things off, but also none of the ability that children have to get very upset and to have crises and breakdowns of an upset and periods of bad behavior and all the rest of it, because I could never allow myself to do any of that. And I there was a moment where my mother, I really remember her saying to someone, it was during a kind of moral panic about teenagers in the 1970s, and mum saying to this person, "Well, you know, that never happened to Justin. He never went off the rails at all." And I remember thinking at the time, "Well, bloody hell, I didn't have the opportunity to go off the rails, because it was all a performance in order to keep her on the rails and to keep her happy." And that I don't think I fully realized until having children of my own, realizing what proper childhood looked like, and reaching, you know, my 60s and looking back on my life. But that's not exactly as you say, that's not to blame her at all. It's just to be more open and honest with myself, I suppose, about that relationship. And through that, to make the point that all these relationships, even ones that we think at the time are wonderfully nourishing, all human relations have upsides and downsides and balances that change during the course of them. And that is an interesting fact.
Well, by way of contact, maybe for our listeners who are less familiar with your life story, your mother was married before, and then she had a child, and we'll come to that in a second, i.e. you, after the divorce, and then married your stepfather, who obviously was not your biological father. But you do inject quite a lot of humour in the book by referring to your mother's quite extreme snobbery. You know, she even occasionally, the Queen was seen as common compared to your mother.
She thought the Queen was common because the Queen opened up her house. I think in the late 1960s, when the royal family first decided to open up Buckingham Palace to the TV cameras, Mum thought it was common and she shouldn't have done it. But she also thought a whole list of things. I mean, I could give you, you know, I couldn't give you the exclusive list because I couldn't remember them all. But, you know, among them were stressing the second syllable of the word controversy. So she couldn't stand people who said controversy. Begonias, which she thought were a lower middle class plant that people put in their gardens. The word toilet, anything that was French that had been anglicized. So parfum, if it became perfume, could not be pronounced. She called it scent. And actually there was a whole list of kind of French things. Serviette was a napkin. Dessert was pudding. And all of those things. So, but it wasn't just the words. It was the kind of the whole thing that went along with it, that we had a way of speaking that excluded most people. And that was terribly important to her. She was, you know, a snobbery, as I say in the book, wasn't the elephant in the room, it was the whole room. And yet at the same time, and again, this goes to complication and complexity of people, she was the most sort of internationalist. She was a Quaker, she was a member of CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Amnesty International. She was really keen towards her later years peace person, and quite a serious person. Although, as you suggest, she certainly grew up. I mean, her early years were quite unserious and quite. And I think post-war, again, we forget how close the 70s were to the war. And my mum's upbringing damaged by the war, and then her immediate adult life. She married a guy, a really unsuitable guy who she never talked much about, who was an alcoholic, and that marriage didn't go anywhere. And then she had the liaison with my father, who was the chief reporter of the Daily Mirror, Peter Woods, in those days, before he went on to be a BBC newsreader, and all sorts of things that just didn't work and didn't last. In a country that was still very much in the lee of the war. And I forget how sort of physically damaged Britain was, and of course other European countries as well, by the war, the kind of physical evidence of it, the bomb sites, the kind of the people who weren't there who should have been there. And all of that, I think, was part of still the 70s, and there'd been this great outpouring of joy in the 60s, and to an extent a breakdown of class barriers, and then a bit of a retrenchment in Britain in the 70s as we tried to work out what to do with this freedom and decided we didn't like it or weren't happy with who we are.
You were sent away to a Quaker school, Sidcot School, when you were 11, I think, presumably at that time.
That's right, 11.
I think one of the harshest things you say about your mother in the book, even though you have a huge affection and love for her and understanding of her, you talk about, you know, sent to school was 40 minutes down the road. And sorry, Mum, that's a crime. That's a pretty stinging rebuke. Mm. Do you ever understand why? Because you weren't a particularly well-off family. Why you were sent away to boarding school in the first
place? Yeah, I mean, she sent me there, she said, because... And again, you know, these are conversations we never had because everything was so repressed. The fact of my biological father reading the news in the corner of the room, but we never had any contact with him. The oddness of my stepfather, who was obviously deeply strange from an early age, he'd be pouring the milk down the sink and replacing the garage doors every few weeks because he thought people were tampering with the car. There's all these kind of weird things happening, but I never felt that I had the ability. And my own children say to me about the school, why don't you just say it's the hellhole, I want to come home? And I, which is a kind of natural reaction now. And I have to say to them, because it was the 70s and you just didn't. But not only was it the 70s, I also lived in a peculiarly repressed household where nothing could be said openly. Right. So to the extent that my mother ever explained the school, it was for my own good and it was to get me out of this peculiar house. And it was an effort to make sure that I had wider horizons, but the downside was that it was awful. Although again, you know, I never told her at the time, as I say in the book, my letters home, all kind of perfectly perky letters home. And
there's a happy end in the sense you do say in the book that on your last day at school, you were overcome with melancholy about the idea of leaving. So obviously it turned out all right in the end.
Well, that's a strange thing about boarding school though, isn't it? And the intensity of the relationships that you have.
Yeah.
And it captures you, not necessarily in a good way, I think. And there'll be generations, particularly of English men of my kind of age, who recognize that that love and hate. There's a wonderful book by a guy called Richard Beard called Sad Little Men, which he wrote, I think, a year or two ago about his experience of Radley, a much posher school than mine. And just, you know, the kind of psychological way in which people are groomed, actually, in a sense, into believing that it's good for them, and then they send their children and all the rest of it. It is a peculiar English vice, the boarding school, and I'm pretty blunt about it in the school. I'm not a fan of it.
Right. Well, you talked about your deeply troubled stepfather. One thing which leaps off the page in the book is that on the morning of your 12th birthday, your father tried to kill himself. Obviously, he was unsuccessful. I mean, how difficult was it to even write about that, never mind experience it at the time?
Not that difficult because he was so removed from me emotionally, and my mother had made sure that he would be, perhaps rightly, but it was such an odd household because we always regarded him as a stranger. She used to tell me that when I was quite young, I said turned to her one day and said, "Where did we get Charles?" Charles was his name, and she thought that was quite funny. But actually, looking back at it, my goodness, that's a very strange way to refer to the stepfather who nominally is meant to be your father and with whom you are living for your entire childhood. Where did we get Charles? So because of that, actually, that separation, when he tried to kill himself and when he did peculiar things, it had little effect on me at the time. It's interesting writing about it and looking back on it because, again, the secrecy around mental illness, which we don't have now, thank goodness, but it was a kind of shaming thing, and we never talked about it, didn't talk about it to each other, but also I don't think my mother ever told anyone that he'd done it, and I don't think he did either.
You say in the book, your mother did say, Justin mustn't be odd, so she's obviously very concerned there'd be no knock-on effect on you and your behaviour.
Yeah, I think there was a sort of moment where she thought, oh my goodness, this is a very strange childhood that I'm giving this child, and she couldn't find a way out of it. Now, that again goes to why I was sent to the school, I think. And we had this weird incident where a deprived child, as he was called, was going to come and stay with us. And then in the end, the deprived child never turned up. And I really can remember kind of ploughing through the food, the sausages that we had cooked for the deprived child as well as my own, and thinking that was quite a good thing. And also thinking, well, it's good because I can spend this afternoon listening to my radio and I don't need to talk to anyone else. And I think, you know, looking back, that's not necessarily a happy sign, actually. And actually, the deprived child, who I'm sure genuinely was deprived, was possibly not deprived in other ways that I was deprived in. And that whole kind of phrase was an interesting one to use, because my mother, unironically, thought that this was a deprived child coming to our household. But actually, really, the deprivation, I think, emotionally, was in our household as much as anywhere else.
The moment she told you who your biological father was, by saying to the turning to the TV and say, "That's your father," how old were you at that time? At that point,
do you know, I honestly can't remember, but I certainly under 10, I think. But it sticks.
Was it as casual as you make it out to be?
Completely, yeah. So there we are. He came on the news. I think he was reading the early evening news, which he didn't normally do, and I'd probably just been watching the children's hour programs with Peter or something, and there he was, and she said, "That's your father," and I said, "Oh," and it was all to do with the balance of payments, which were very gloomy, and he looked a bit gloomy too.
Right.
And that was really the end of it, and we never really talked about him again.
And neither you nor she made any attempt or wanted to make contact with him, or he with you?
No, right. None at all. And I know that my mother would have been deeply upset if I'd tried to contact him. And I know sort of viscerally, I never asked her, but I know viscerally that it would have been she would have found it very discombobulating and worse, actually. So I never made any effort to. And actually, you know, looking at it more positively, I don't think I really felt a great desire to, actually. I didn't feel the absence. And the book is not about the absence of a father. It's very much about the presence of a mother and the presence of other things, not all of them good, but all of them there. But it was odd that he was there, and there was this occasion where he did the Morecambe and Wise show with all the news readers.
Yes, dressed up as sailors.
That's right, dressed up as sailors. And it's a really famous kind of moment in British television, isn't it? Would have been watched by pretty much the whole nation, who was still sober just before Christmas. And there he is singing, "There Ain't Nothing Like a Dame," at the end of it.
And am I right in saying also you didn't actually, not that it's anybody else's business, frankly, it's just you didn't reveal this, if reveal the right word, until an article you wrote in the Radio Times about 10
That's
years
right.
ago.
That's right. Well, I didn't want to say anything about it until he was dead and his first wife was dead and my mother was. And so I left it. But then once they all were, my own children used to say to me, "What's going on? Why don't we know anything about your father?" And then I thought, actually, hang on, I think I have the right to, and they have the right just to have it out there publicly.
Right. Well, you finished the book by talking about your first steps inside the BBC. You're taken on as a graduate trainee, and you have the, with great honesty, Justin, you say you and Jeremy Bowen, your great friend, you wanted to be front of house on stage. We ambitioned already to be out there dodging the bullets and getting the girl. None of this kind of boring behind the scenes stuff without getting any recognition and credit. That's been your mantra for the rest of your professional career, has it?
And it's this kind of this narcissism, which I try to explore in the book. I think performing, when you're young and you have to perform from the age of kind of 4 or 5 onwards, because you've got to keep the show on the road, I wonder if it does have the impact of making you very conscious all the time of wanting to perform and actually approbation being important to you, more important to you, public approbation being more important to you than it is to a normal person. And I don't know what Jeremy's psychological wellsprings are that have got him to always want to be in front of the camera. I should ask him, actually, shouldn't I? But for me, I do... kind of interests me and slightly horrifies me, actually, the extent to which, even as a child and actually a rather shy child, I was very keen to be kind of looked at, actually, and have people kind of pay attention to me. It's not at all a positive trait, I don't think, and it's not something I'm particularly proud of. It's something I'm very, very conscious was always there. So when we arrived at the BBC, Jeremy and I were absolutely certain we had all these nightmare kind of production jobs that actually lead to the more senior roles in the BBC, including Director General, if you stick at it. But we knew perfectly well we wanted to be prancing about, not behind the scenes.
Well, you basically, people maybe forget now because your career has been so much in the radio the past few years, but you started your career course in the BBC on TV, in front of the camera on breakfast and 6 o'clock news. Wasn't a lot of comment, I'm trying to cast my mind back to those days when you were a young guy on television, that you were criticised for having a too posh a voice?
Yes, very much. So the accent that my mother had absolutely demanded that I would have, this kind of cut glass Queen's English accent, which to an extent I've lost, but to an extent obviously I haven't, and the correct pronunciation of controversy and a whole raft of other words, she thought was going to make my career starred and wonderful. It then turned out, of course, it's the complete opposite. So, you know, the BBC correspondents and presenters, actually, who are most fated now, are the ones who sound matey, who've got regional accents. So I completely lost out owing to mum and her obsession with things that might have been very valuable in the 1950s, but actually already by the late 70s and early 80s were becoming less so. So yeah, I have I've managed to scrape in. I don't think anyone talking like me now would necessarily expect to have the career that I've had.
Well, as we know, you have the perfect face for radio, so it's been a happy ending all the time. I'm going to try in the last minute or so of this great conversation to try and draw you into something which is a bit political, I suppose, and you may just brush me away, but the future of the BBC, frankly, about how, you know, the regular, you know, commentary about their being under attack, under threat. And maybe you might say it was ever thus, always the case. But are we at a particular a fragile point at the moment for the BBC, or was it part, for you and your experience, par for the course?
Well, I mean, it's partly par for the course. The BBC is always attacked and always should be attacked because it's widely owned and it's widely discussed and it's got so many fingers in so many pies that it's perfectly legitimate for people to talk about it and to discuss its future. Are we at a particular stage now? And I suppose the reason we are is technology as much as anything else, probably technology more than politics. The fact is that a lot of particularly young people don't engage with normal broadcasting in a way that they used to.
So it's a question of relevance rather than politicians trying to
the relevance question then goes to the way that it's funded question, because if it's not relevant to people, then how do you take money from them all? And we have this license fee where everyone with a TV pays. And if you don't do that, can you maintain some sort of universality where it is genuinely owned and is a cultural enterprise that everyone is served by and is involved in, if you don't then take money, as it were, from almost everyone? And those are the things that have to be worked out. So it's a much wider question than kind of this government doesn't like the BBC or that government does. It's a question about how you fund and whether you think that sort of public service broadcasting and having this huge organisation at the centre of it is a good thing or a bad thing.
Okay, well, we have to leave it there, Justin. One of the many reveals in your book is that you've never listened to a podcast. I hope that you will make an exception, at least for this one. I thought, blimey, accepts invitation to a podcast, having admitted
I listened to everything you said during. Actually, can I just say on the podcast, they never listen to a podcast. And that's the other thing about going to a Quaker school. You see, you become very, and I say it in the context of being comfortable with silence.
Yeah.
And there is something really interesting about that. So my school did all sorts of awful things and it was a bit of a hellhole. But it was also somewhere you learn as a Quaker to be comfortable with nothing happening at all. And in the podcast age, it is unusual. So I cling to my not listening talent.
Well, I will send this one to you as soon as Justin and challenge you on questioning on it afterwards. We have to leave it there. Justin Webb, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Paul.